The Environment, Agriculture, and Flooding Subcommittee will now come to order. Victoria, please call the roll.
Chair Buchanan?
Here.
Vice Chair Cheney? Democratic Ranking Member Alexander?
Here.
Representatives Brannon?
Here.
Usada Cabrera? Daly?
Here.
Diamond?
Here.
Fine?
Here.
Hardy? Hunchowski?
Here.
Lamarca? McFarland? Mello?
Here.
Mooney?
Here.
Pomfroy? Overdorf? Tomko?
Here.
Trunau?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Victoria. Members, announcements. I want to remind everyone to please remember to turn off or silence your cell phones or other communication devices. And I wanted to welcome everyone back to the Agriculture, Flooding, and Environmental Subcommittee. We have a few new additions that I'm very excited about who are joining in our committee. Representative Brennan is a new addition to our committee, and also Representative Mello. So welcome to our committee. I also want to make another special announcement. We have a new vice chair. Representative Cheney will be our vice chair this session. So we are very excited. As we all know, you're very talented, and you'll do a phenomenal job in your role, and you'll be a great leader on this committee. And I also want to acknowledge my counterpart, our ranking member, Alexander. We look forward to working with you again this session. And we do have another addition, Victoria Runnels, who's our new administrative assistant. So welcome, and we're excited about that. Folks, we've got about an hour and 15 minutes. What we'll do today is we're going to spend some time with the DEP Secretary Hamilton and discuss something that's very important, not only to me, but to folks in my greater delegation and the state of Florida around what's going on at Piney Point. As many of you probably know, this was a major line item as it relates to our budget this last session, and it's something that's very important to many of us. So without further ado, what we'll do is we'll bring up Secretary Sean Hamilton, and we'll recognize him. And then afterwards, members, what we're going to do is open it up for some questions. So I'd encourage folks that have questions around the presentation to please set those aside and be ready to ask. Secretary Hamilton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Sean Hamilton, Secretary with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. It's my pleasure to be here to provide you with an update on Piney Point and answer any questions you may have. But before we go into too much detail, I just want to kind of give you just a little bit of a technical overview of what we're principally talking about. You know, that's kind of at the heart of this. As far as phosphate processing is concerned, just so you know, one of the most elemental functions is the actual creation of those products. Phosphate rock is mixed with sulfuric acid, and that produces a phosphoric acid that's used in fertilizer, right? But you get a calcium sulfate byproduct, and that byproduct is what's required and currently put into those stack systems. And so we'll talk a lot about stacks and things of that nature, but just kind of giving you an overview of what's happening there. In most cases, a lot of those stack systems, they'll have water processing systems at the top, basically allows that calcium sulfite to settle out, add to the stack, and then that water's returned back into the processing to aid in the fertilizer production. Obviously, there are rules and regulations, extensive rules and regulations that govern these stacks, you know, ranging from the siting, the construction, the operation, and ultimately the closure and long-term care of their systems. And so that, you know, again, that's an extensive rule set that goes with that that continues to mature over time. And then, you know, lastly, there's financial assurance that goes with that to make sure that there's availability of the financial resources for the proper closure and long-term care as needed of these facilities. So on to the history. I'll try to do a quick walkthrough of the history here. And this site, as you would imagine, has a long and somewhat peppered history, so to speak, with, you know, changes of ownership and bankruptcies. First, 1965, Borden Chemical basically came into existence as the facility was first constructed. And then through the 80s and 90s, a series of ownership transfers, as you can see there from the graphic at the site. Roster Phosphates underwent the first bankruptcy associated with the site. And then later on, that facility was acquired by Fertilizer Development Corporation, which ultimately led to the formation of Mulberry Corporation, which is a name you may be familiar with in some of its subsidiary companies. And then in 2001, Mulberry Corporation filed for bankruptcy and abandoned the site. And it was through those proceedings we've got our first occurrence of a receiver being appointed to the site. Following that action, the department continued to provide regulatory oversight for the site's process water management, treatment, and removal activities, as well as closure work that was being conducted at the time. 2006, the bankruptcy trustee sells the property to the current site owner, HRK. When HRK purchased the property, they ultimately assumed the responsibility for the day-to-day operations at the site and the long-term care of the facility, and then, of course, planned closure work. In an attempt to generate revenue, including additional funds for long-term care, as well as establish a beneficial use for the site, they entered into an agreement with the Port of Manatee to use the line reservoir to contain and process dredge materials and clarify and return the seawater back to the Port of Manatee. And just to kind of walk you through that process a little bit, if you can imagine a kind of a suction dredge process where it's pulling those sediments from the bottom, pumping it into this empty line pond, allowing the sediments to settle out and returning clean seawater back to the bay. And that's a pretty robust way to do dredging. And so that was a thought process with that system. And then work toward closure continued at the site. By 2010, over 2.3 billion gallons of processed water was safely treated and removed from the site. And prior construction, construction activities at the site were completed. Okay, it's at this time that things, you know, the removal process was moving forward and there was a good bit of, you know, progress. But however, there was some amount of processed water still remaining on the site in one of the compartments. And then, so in 2011 is when things got increasingly, exponentially more complicated and challenging at the site. That is when the dredge process, you know, took off and we had our first liner tear at the site. The failure meant that, first of all, that the ongoing dredge process and that clarification could no longer proceed. And then secondarily to that, what we lost was also an inability to continue the removal of remaining processed water at the site. And that was happening at that time principally by sending it over to the county's wastewater treatment plant. So just to kind of walk you through what that entailed and how that played out. If you can imagine, when this dredge process started, you had one pond with remaining processed water that was on the site, basically gonna have all your contaminants that you're concerned about. You got one clean site that's principally seawater and the dredge material. Those are two separate, totally, you know, self-contained systems. The tear happens and basically results in an intermingling of those waters. And so now you've got seawater mixed with contaminated water and vice versa. And so that's why, A, it ceased the dredge process, but also limited the ability to continue water going over to the disposal facility at the county. And then in 2012, HRK Holdings files for bankruptcy. 2014, HRK is still the owner. DEP pursues enforcement, executes a consent order, and the goal again was to drive them toward getting financial assurance and drive them toward, you know, getting to a point for closure and removing the water for the site. You know, again, as the owner, that's, you know, that was the goal. And then 2014 through 20, they continued to maintain the site with, you know, obviously department regulatory oversight, but however, HRK was unable to provide, you know, sufficient financial assurance and the required long-term care and water management needs at the site. All right, on to more recent activities. So late March of the year, HRK notified the department that they were having increased conductivity in water volume entering its own site stack seepage collection system, indicating a possible liner tear at NGS South compartment. And basically what that means is they saw indications of two things, right? Increased volume in the drainage ditches around the site, but not only the increased volume of water, what was in the water was indicative of water that may have been coming from the stack system. On March 29th, DEP issued an emergency final order requiring HRK to take immediate action and implement all necessary steps to maintain the integrity of the stack system. And the key component there, if there was a seepage coming through that site, embankment, you risk a erosion event or something that could basically invalidate that whole structure of the side of the facility. Then on March 30, HRK initiated emergency untreated discharges to Tampa Bay in order to keep the integrity of the stack system and prevent uncontrolled discharge to Bishop Harbor in Tampa Bay and outstanding Florida water. So basically directing this water to the port, but also lowering, more importantly, lowering that lake level and that pressure on that seepage to prevent that potential catastrophic failure of the barm. That was the purpose of the discharge. Then, of course, on April 3rd, the governor declared a local state of an emergency, which allowed us to marshal resources and bring DEM into play to help us manage the response associated with the site and, again, initiate those steps to prevent that south compartment collapse. April 7th through the 10th are, again, another key component. Once the emergency was abated from that collapse meeting, there was enough water removed from that south compartment to remove the risk of a catastrophic failure. The next key activities were centered around stopping the leak, putting in the necessary steps and repairs to stop the seepage and, you know, hopefully, again, abate any subsequent risk of further seepage and our catastrophic failures. And so just a little bit of talk about that went into that. There were a lot of different teams that came to play. But one of the things, if you think about the complexity that goes in there was deployment of underwater sonar. There were cameras. There were geologists. There were a lot of things that went in play in a very short window to effectively bring this to a quick closure. And then once the location was identified with all of the systems that I talked to you about, basically a metal plate was basically fabricated and placed at the line of terror underwater, and other additional materials and resources were put in place with the plate to stabilize it and make sure it held in place, including a large quantity of sand. And so all of that took place, that sand placement took a better part of May, building the berm and the protective cover around that seepage temporary patch. The repair was successful and is still holding to this day as far as the seepage is concerned. And just in summary, just a couple of different actions. Again, I talked about the geotechnical evaluations. Those, again, were principally to identify the source of the leak, evaluate, the stability of that side bank in the area associated with the leak. And then other things included implementing innovative technology at the site for water treatment. And again, the thought process was there with the innovative treatment, let's go in, let's treat the water, reduce any remaining water to as safe of a standard as we could relevant to the nutrient loading potential for the bay. And that continues to this day. And then additionally to that, there was also continued water management activities that has to continue for the simple fact that it's going to take time to close it. And so with that in mind, we have to maintain the water, or at least in this case, the operator and the receiver, they must maintain the water at a safe level to prevent two things, right? Any type of uncontrolled overtopping of the berms of partially treated water. And so that's why these interim water management activities are important. And they've ranged from trucking to nearby wastewater treatment systems to the resumption of some integrated systems, which includes some aeration and direct piping to the county's wastewater treatment systems. And so again, those continue. Cleaning the impact of stormwater areas, that was important too, just to kind of give you a sense of scope and scale of what was required at the site. Because of the catastrophic issue failure before, the stormwater systems became impacted. And what that means, you no longer are able to discharge clean contact stormwater from the site. And so basically, you exponentially increase the amount of water you have to keep on site because you no longer have clean stormwater that's allowed to leave the site. And so there's a lot of cleaning, a lot of recovery, and more importantly, a lot of testing went into place to recover the stormwater capability of the site. And so now the site has a substantial amount of clean stormwater that hasn't had any contact with the processed water that's allowed to discharge as required and as permitted from the site. So that was an important recovery. And of course, there's been extensive and ongoing monitoring around the site, on the facility, ranging from obviously the ambient conditions in the water, but also the water levels at the site, and make sure those feed the thought process of active water management. Again, overall conditions at the site, they remain stable. In that term, stable means that the patch is holding, right? But it does mean there's still, like I said, impounded water. There are things that require day-to-day awareness and management. There's day-to-day needs for additional, you know, monitoring of water levels, as you can imagine here in Florida. But water treatment continues. And again, the thought process with keeping that water treatment going, in the unfortunate event that a discharge is required or happens, that water is of the highest quality possible as far as the nutrient loading. And right now, typically, if there was a controlled discharge, you're talking about a reduction of about 97% of the nutrient load that happened when it was uncontrolled, when this event first happened. And again, of course, the monitoring is ongoing to support that. And of course, the water management I talked to you about piping it over to the reclamation facility and the spray evaporation system. Those systems are operable now. That grabs us about 250,000 gallons a day. Not a lot, but, you know, as we get out of the rainy season, helps us kind of hopefully maintain that water level. Just path forwards, enforcement. Again, we stated early on, we will do everything in our power to make sure, you know, the site owner is held accountable. And as on August the 5th, 2021, DEP filed a complaint in the 12th Judicial Circuit Court. Again, the goal is maximum penalties, 100% cost recovery to the extent we can. And again, doing everything we can to make sure HRK is held accountable. And most of those issues range that we've identified are safe operations. Then, of course, administrative code violations pertaining to surface and groundwater standards and provisions in the existing consent order and administrative agreements that they were in violation of. And then, of course, lastly, financial assurance requirements, the inability to obtain appropriate financial assurance. And in that complaint, we also filed and requested a court-appointed receiver. We wanted somebody who's acting in the sole interest of the safety of that site and its closure. No other competing interest, and also, you know, had the wherewithal for us, the state, since, again, based on your support in the governor's direction, funding a viable entity that would be focused on closure as we think about the funding sources that have been provided based on your support. So on August the 25th, the judge issued an order appointing a court-appointed receiver, and now that receiver is responsible for the day-to-day management and will, again, be also singularly focused on providing the closure in close coordination with the department from a regulatory oversight perspective. The ultimate goal, again, remains closure. There should be, I just want to make sure I state that as clear as I can. Day-to-day management is important. Make sure we do everything we can abate any type of interim risk, but closure has to be the number one objective associated with this site, and everything with that has to be moving in that direction. So just want to be clear on that. As far as funding, just again, thanks to the support of the governor and the legislature, you know, we were allocated $100 million for the initial phase of this. That money hasn't been tapped into yet, so that will start to be used here to fund the receiver's activities for the purpose of, again, of securing the the activities and the resources, the design, et cetera, for the purpose of closure. And then once that is done, what we would expect to kind of play this out for you, once we get a preliminary design, that'll inform any subsequent, you know, funding needs to permanently or completely, not permanently, but completely close and complete those activities. Can't expect on don't want to speculate on the cost just yet. Just know that we're working to inform that thought process as soon as we can from the activities at the site. And then lastly, I do want to bring on the fact and just identify the fact, obviously, we did issue a draft UIC permit to Manatee County for the purpose of water management at the site. The next step, they will hold a public meeting to discuss the details of that. But once that, if that remains viable, the next step would be to issue a notice of intent that would be publicly noticed and with an appropriate 14-day petition window. And so with that, I'll answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I thought you gave a great explanation chronologically, kind of where how we got to where we're at today. And I wanted to kick it off for questions. I had just a couple questions, and then I'm going to open it up to the committee. Moving forward, as it relates to, you know, closure, time frames, what are we looking at? Because I know you said you didn't want to speculate as it relates to maybe monetary, but what are we looking at in terms of time frames moving forward?
Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. So just to kind of give you a sense of the key considerations, one of the main impediments to getting the closure done is the water on the site. There's 544 approximately million gallons of water on the site that has to be managed and appropriately disposed of. And even if you think about, depending on what technology ultimately becomes the source for the removal of that water, there are a couple of different factors that will drive that. First of all, assuming it's a UIC well and it's optimized to take a million gallons a day, so you can imagine at 544 million gallons on the site and a well that can only take between a million to, you know, 1.5 million a day, that's a day for day, you know, time frame it will take. Now, just to be clear, I would expect that this is a phased process, right? You'll see maybe see portions of the site close once it's dewatered, for lack of a better word. So you'll see progress, but I just want to let you know, give you a sense for the time frame it takes for water management to be able to get to that point to move dirt and do those things appropriately. That's one thing. And then complicate that with the fact that the average rainfall in this area is about 53 inches. Each inch of rain that falls on this site creates 4.6 million gallons of water to manage. And so you're changing the tires on the bus while you're going down the hill. That's why I said laser focus on closure, getting it done, being timely with our actions, because again, each day we delay complicates and furthers this out and, you know, again, keeps that site in play. I know that doesn't answer your question, but I want to get you. So you're talking about a multi-month plus year, you know, a multi-year event to get this done.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I think you did a good job with that. And roughly what would you say in terms of untreated water when it had to be released earlier in the year? How many gallons are we looking at that potentially ended up in the bay?
I want to lifeline. What was that exact number, John? It was 215. I was going to say about 230, but it was 215 million gallons.
And to what extent, because this has been a big part of conversation in the greater Sarasota area, especially around water quality, to what extent do you believe this could have impacted or exacerbated red tide that we had this year?
This question, as you imagine, come up repeatedly, right? And there's a bunch of different debate and schools of thoughts on it from a scientific perspective. And, you know, I state the facts. I try to stick with the facts. Facts of the matter, nutrients exacerbate red tide, period. There's no debate about that. Nutrients don't create and are cause red tide. There's no debate about that. And so not leaving it at that, leaving it at that point, so to speak, I think the question is, any amount of nutrients going in the bay is undesired, you know, least of all from this site, period.
Mr. Secretary, I think we could both agree on that. My last question, are there other sites, you know, of critical concern, such as I'd characterize this one was across the state?
If you're talking about as far as the nature of this activity,
yes.
Okay. This, you know, again, obviously there's extensive phosphate mining in the state. You know, that's a fact that everybody's aware of. You know, one of the things, too, to keep in mind, one of the key differences, those sites are actively either being managed and are closed by active phosphate mining companies who have a financial interest in those, have financial income or whatever. This site was operated by no such entity. You know, with different objectives, different thought processes, different resources. And so that in itself is a big difference, in my opinion, as far as the capability, wherewithal, you know, the scientific background, et cetera, you know, maybe to move this site in a positive direction.
So, Mr. Secretary, you'd say vast majority of these sites are not defunct entities, that it was kind of a perfect storm as it relates to this particular site. Is that what you're saying?
To some degree. Now, keep in mind, we've had a, you know, there's an extensive history here. There have been other companies, other sites that have gone out of business. But in those cases, those sites are currently being operated or under contract or closed by active phosphate facilities. So there's a small subset in that category. But as far as the large majority, they are active companies. And so, that again, that is one major difference. So just want to make sure I clarify that.
Thank you. Members, I'm opening it up for questions. Ranking Member Alexander, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, I want to thank you for your very succinct presentation. You know, I'm not saying this lightly, but oftentimes we'll have presentations and someone will read verbatim from a piece of paper and we all fall asleep. And I think it's very great meaning when you can actually explain in a very thoughtful way the subject matter. It helps us out ascertain what you're talking about. Just real quick, if you can share any insights in regards to interactions with our federal partners, how that's gone in this particular situation, or just in broad context, and whether or not those resources have been helpful, or any general thoughts you have about that interaction.
Mr. Secretary, you're recognized.
Thank you. Most cases, they've been somewhat productive. I say they're somewhat productive because a lot of this response has failed on or basically stepped up by the state. You know, we were, you know, definitely didn't want to delay that and had no choice to delay. And so a large part, a lot of the initial responses have been, you know, provided by the state. There have been conversations with our federal partners and understanding a broader concept of, you know, what is your understanding of what's allowed to happen at this site from a discharge perspective? What's allowed to happen? You know, what are the options out there as you think about water management? What needs to be in place if A, B, or C happens? And so we have had those conversations, and they've been pretty clear to us about what that looks like and what that needs to look like. And so the technical support and guidance is there. So.
Members, other questions? Representative Hardy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it on? Y'all can hear.
You can move over one if you, I can't really hear you, but.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Mr.
Great.
Chair. All right. So I just want to continue up on something that you were just discussing, which is the fact that at other sites there are active owners and the owners have a financial interest in making sure that everything is okay there. But there is a theme, right, of folks not doing well financially and things falling into disrepair. What rules do we have to ensure that financially there are the resources there to take care of every single site that we have here in the state? Because today, the business environment with respect to some of these operations might be okay. In the future, that might not be the case. How can we make sure that no matter what the business environment is, that Floridians in our environment will be protected?
Secretary Hamilton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. There are extensive rules in place for financial assurance, and again, over time, they have matured. You know, there are a lot of sites that predate some of those, or there are some sites that predate those, but as you think about what's inactive now, there's $2 billion in financial assurance in place for those active sites and our sites that will be actively being closed. And those financial instruments are monitored closely for anything that puts them on risk, and two things, anything that happens at the site that puts those financial assurance instruments at risk of being able to cover the issue. And then the second thing, mature those financial instruments as we have issues at sites. If we find for some reason that there's a contingency that needs to be accounted for, we've taken the liberty to start incorporate that back into the financial instrument for the site to make sure those type of emergencies. So again, it's a maturation process that's continuing, but right now upwards of $2 billion to cover those active and sites that are active and are actively being closed.
Representative Hardy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the financial assurances, they're specific to each individual site. So for example, if there is an issue at another site and you need to mature some of those financial instruments to take care of that, you can't pull some of the resources from one site to another site. I just want to be clear because, you know, my question is, in the event that you would need those additional resources, it could be that the economics at the particular site might not support that. And so I'm just wondering, It's tough because if there's no money there, there's no money there.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering what assurances are there to prevent this from ever happening again?
Secretary, you're recognized.
Each one of those financial instruments, they are based on the valuation of each specific site, right? In some cases, you're going to find that those financial instruments are secured by either one corporation that has multiple sites. But at the end of the day, each site still needs to remain the financial assurance capability for that site. So if you have something at one site, it is not allowed to deplete the capability to close the remaining sites, if that makes sense. And same thing, we are not, those financial instruments are tied to that corporation's assets and their sites. And so an issue, of course, at another corporate site or another entity site would not allow us to pull that money over. And so again, they're basically segmented for their individual purpose of closure and financial assurance.
Representative Hardy.
Thank you. My last question is, what can we do to give you and future people in your shoes as many tools as possible to prevent this and other accidents like this from occurring? If you could ask us for anything, what would that be? How can we best equip you to protect Floridians and our environment with respect to matters such as this?
Secretary Hamilton.
Thank you for that question. And I'll have to back up a little bit and tell you a little bit a personal perspective just from being a regulatory director for so long and experiencing, you know, the tip of the spear where policy meets execution. One of the things, we have an extensive rule set associated with these facilities. And again, they've continued to mature all the time. And so the first thing I have to ask myself and work with the team, are we taking full advantage of the execution of the rules we have now? And that's a question that I'm asking. That's a question I'm continuing to research and learn and make sure, because I believe in always making sure that you're doing everything that you're required and authorized to do now to make these safe. As far as any gaps with that, again, it's a matter of execution, in my opinion, of what we have on the books now. And then if policy needs to be informed from any shortcomings, we do everything we can to provide that feedback to, you know, folks such as yourself that may inform that policy and may change that direction. So that's a work in progress. But like I said, extensive rule sets, extensive financial assurance in place. Now it's a matter of due diligence and making sure it's where it needs to be holistically.
And Mr. Secretary, just to kind of follow, piggyback up on that, is there anything, and I think you did a great job of answering that, but as it relates to the department, is there anything, as it relates to hindsight with what occurred here, has it prompted the department to review some of the rules, procedures, or was there lessons that could be gleaned from what occurred here?
And one of the things, the difficulty, of course, is rewinding that tape and knowing, as you know, what were some of those decision points back then. But I will tell you from a technical perspective, if there's any opportunity to leverage anything that makes any subsequent permit for any facility more safe within the rule box we have, we are doing everything we can and have to do that now. In fact, you know, one of the most subsequent permits to that incorporated some technical aspects, additional liner surveys, doing construction, post-construction, additional geological evaluations, everything that we could incorporate within the capability and the authority we have now, we're doing that to this point right now. So I don't, you know, again, as far as some of the decision makings with this site, you know, Those are some tough questions related to that, because you look at those and you go, not maybe at this point, right? There's some different considerations that should have been had.
Members, questions? Representative Mooney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A great presentation. Very, very informative. A question, aside from the infrastructure side, has there been any studies started on the impacts of the 215 million gallons of untreated water into the ecosystem there? And if so, have you seen any drastic results in the near shore water and surrounding waters as it impacts the ecosystem and sea life?
Mr. Secretary, you're recognized.
Yes, thank you for the question, Rep. As far as the actual water quality based on ambient conditions, it's back to near background. You know, when you think about all of the different parameters that are monitored on a daily basis, I will tell you, you know, our folks, our monitoring staff that's involved with this, and definitely the estuary teams and the folks who are involved and live and eat and breathe that environment every day, they're fully vested in doing just what you said. And we are supplying additional resources to them in the way of dollars for test kits, whatever we can do to support that. And I think that evaluation and discussion is ongoing.
Members, questions? Representative Mello, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, well, maybe I'll just yell. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Secretary. In your presentation, you mentioned implementing innovative technology to treat the water. Can you provide some examples of how you're doing that? Because it sounds like we definitely need to reduce volume. Can you share with us some of those examples?
Mr. Secretary, you're recognized.
Thank you. As far as the site's concerned, the innovative tech there, one of its principal focus right now with the innovative tech there is to deal with the phosphorus and the nitrogen in the water. That's its principal focus, and that's the technology that's there. And so far, like I said, they're able to ascertain like a 97% to 99% reduction in the amount of phosphorus and nitrogen at the site. What that leaves, though, there's still other parameters. Maybe there's some metals and things of this nature. So the reason I say all of that is there's still work to be done if you want to compare it to ambient conditions and are being able to meet certain surface water standards. And so, but the principal accomplishment is the reduction in the nutrients at the site, and that capability remains. Because as you previously discussed, right, we want to make sure in the unlikely event that we minimize any additional nutrient load into the bay. And so that's been the principal focus of that technology that has and is currently on the site.
Thank you.
Representative Diamond, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Secretary. I appreciate the conversations we've had over the summer and the leadership that you've provided. The situation, obviously, with the red tide in Pinellas County was just unbelievably terrible. And I think it's clear to me that, as you explained, that the nutrients that we've had discharged into Tampa Bay have exacerbated that problem. And I just wanted to go back to make sure I understand a couple of these issues. With regard to a company like HRK and the sort of financial requirements for one of these companies to take ownership of a stack. So there is a requirement currently in DEP rules that gives your agency the ability to assure that there are the resources there in place to pay for a cleanup like this if something, God forbid, like this happens again?
Secretary Hamilton.
Yes, sir, most definitely. And if you go back to that history, if you think about the fact that you're talking about a site that went through a couple of different bankruptcies, and then finally at that last bankruptcy was acquired by a company that wasn't an active mining company or didn't necessarily have that in its intent. And so, again, just looking at that difference, that is a big difference considering that all of the other sites we have, especially ones who are currently with the rule sets we have now, that those financial capabilities and requirements are in place.
Follow up.
Thank you for that answer. And I guess I'd be very interested in hearing, and I'm sure others on the committee would be interested in hearing, when DEP is done sort of with this review of the, I understand you have an extensive set of rules on these issues. Mm-hmm. And I share the comments of the chairman and the other people on the committee who said, whatever we can do to support you in your effort to make sure you have every regulatory tool at your disposal, I'll be interested in hearing from you as to how that review went and whether there's going to be additional rulemaking from DEP, you know, in this section or not. I mean, do you anticipate at this point in your review that there's going to be the need to write additional rules or that we need to do anything from a legislative perspective to give you support in that regard?
Secretary Hamilton, you're recognized.
No, I don't see that as of my current, because really one of the things to keep in mind is the first thing you look at is the what is the current status of the sites from the regulatory requirements? And right now, they're in compliance. They're meeting the necessary rule sets. They've had the financial assurance in place. But when I think about, okay, when I think about a review, I think about if there are any opportunities to add additional either assurances, safeguards, whatever. When I think about those, we're talking about items that are above and beyond than what's required now, not necessarily because there is a big gap or deficiency, just because, again, I always want to continue to mature that process. And so, like I said, not yet. I don't have anything for you yet, and I can't give you a good, you know, kind of a partial thumbs up that that's pending. But again, that's just the way I think, having been in a regulatory role, to make sure we do that kind of comprehensive evaluation.
Rep Diamond.
And in terms of this, the staffing in your agency to make sure those rules are enforced, I mean, do you feel that you have the adequate staffing and support you need there in terms of the enforcement piece? In other words, do you have enough people in your agency looking at these sites with these rules in mind?
Mr. Secretary, you're recognized.
Yes, sir, we do. Okay. Most definitely. Yeah.
Sorry, I have one more.
Absolutely. Chairman, Representative Diamond, you're recognized.
Thank you for the courtesy. I've been reading, I represent Pinellas County, but I've been reading about the plan with in Manatee County to inject the treated wastewater into the well that we were just discussing. Can you talk a little bit more about the environmental impacts of that decision? I've read conflicting information on that. I mean, are you concerned at all about the impact that would have on our aquifer?
Mr. Secretary, you're recognized.
Rep, thank you for the question, sir. Just to kind of walk through that a little bit, the UIC, or the Underground Injection Control Program, has been around for quite a bit. It is a very, very proven technology in the state in Florida. It's a federally delegated program. And, you know, as I sit here, you know, in understanding what goes with that program, we would not obviously be supportive of anything that directly put our drinking water at risk. And so in this particular case, you're talking about a system, you know, with a well that'll be, you know, potentially, again, I don't want to make any predeterminations about this permit actually being issued. One of the things to keep in mind is that still got to go through that progress. But if it were to move forward, you're talking about a well that would dispose of water in an unused zone that has a confining layer that is very protective of our drinking aquifer, over 3,000 plus feet deep. But just to kind of walk you through that process, because I think it's important to gain an appreciation for what goes in that. And again, I get the concerns and I understand that. And I think we need to make sure, to your point, we educate and be purposeful in those discussions. But as you think about this technology itself, just in this particular case, you know, just kind of walk you through that process. Not only there's a comprehensive geology survey and everything that has to happen, but even in the construction process, it's one of the most intense regulated overview processes. The evaluation, the testing is intense. For example, each drill section that you pull up from a coring, every segment of that geology has to be verified. So it's one thing to speculate what it looks like down below there. It's another thing to verify that it is what you think it is. And so you got to make it through that point. Then you construct the well. All right, we've constructed the well as expected. Everything's good. No, there's extensive testing and verification that the well will perform under a clean set of circumstances before we risk the aquifer or even the substrate under that. And so you're talking multiple months of testing before it ever gets to a point of a production well. And then once all the data's in, there's an extensive evaluation and application of public-facing process to review that before another permit is issued to actually put the well in production. And so again, and you were talking about some geologists, who you're talking about engineers, you're talking about folks combing over data, you know, geological information and everything to make sure it is as safe as possible.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, and just to kind of piggyback on that, what is the water quality going to look like of the water that's actually going into the well at the time it's put in?
Thank you for the question. So really, one of the things, since we're going into a zone of the aquifer that's unused, there are no water quality targets that you have to achieve. However, there is two things, right? There's the ambient, the ongoing treatment that's happening that we've talked about and I've described to you, but there's a pretreatment that has to happen before the water is injected. And just to understand, to clarify the purpose of that pretreatment, it is to protect and maintain the integrity of the well. And so there will be pretreatment, principally remove solids and things like phosphorus that could put the well's integrity, clog it up, and do anything else at, you know, at risk. And so there will be pretreatment that will occur. But again, it's not for the purpose of meeting a drinking water standard. It's the purpose of maintaining the integrity and the safety of the well.
Members, questions? Representative Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary, just wanted to say you're doing a fantastic job leading the DEP, and we're glad to have you in that position. So thank you very much for being here today. And also, I appreciate your comment about your employees. You need some more, and we understand that. Many of us understand that. We'll do our best to help you out with that. Within your other departments, you're doing a great job here, but thank you so much for what you're doing. Just a clarification to kind of put it in layman's terms, if you will, on a closure of a site. A closure of a site really doesn't mean there's no more activity at the site, but instead you have a direct set of circumstances that say, all right, this site is now closed. And you also have some assurances that it, quote unquote, won't be opened again. There's things like that. What if you could just elaborate a little bit more on what does it mean to be closed? Does it mean that the area is sealed? Does it mean we're going to be adding fill? Does it mean we now have the program of doing deep injection entirely? What, in kind of a layman's term, if you could just describe, what does it mean that the site's now closed and we can close the book on this, if you will, and turn the page?
Secretary Hamilton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Rep, thank you for the question, sir. One of the things, you know, principle, right, is to make sure we permanently abate the risk of retaining large volumes of water at this site. And so that's number one. But as far as a closure is concerned, getting rid of the water obviously is the precursor to that. And so you're talking about getting to a point where the site, the only thing coming off of that site to a large degree is clean stormwater, meaning that you've removed that contact risk. You secure the site, you secure the surfaces, so stormwater doesn't come in contact with the material that will remain on the site, thereby continuing to produce contact water. So you're talking about a closure design that creates a barrier between stormwater, good clean fill, and then, of course, what's below the surface. And so at the end of the day, you're talking about the site where you're managing basically contact stormwater, you're managing and making sure that there's no extensive erosion and things of this nature that would put that at risk, and then you're talking about some amount of a system to maintain any seepage that may happen, you know, associated with the material that remains on the site. And so basically what you want is as passive of a system there that maintains and is safe from a structural perspective from water coming off of the site. And so that has to be the stated goal of closure.
One follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So thank you for that layman's explanation. I really do appreciate that. But that also does mean that we'll be doing monitoring on the site perpetually now until you and I are long gone from this planet. Is that correct?
Mr. Secretary, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. Long-term monitoring will be required. Yes, sir. That is a fact and expected.
Members, questions? Representative Cheney.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. This panel has done a terrific job of asking all of my questions, concerns about impact, red tide, timeline, preventing this from happening again. I just wanted to mention one other thing. I've met with Tampa Bay Estuary, of which DEP and FWC is a part of, and they are closely involved with all of this. So that brings a comfort level to this whole process for me. And then so my question is, where in the process do we put an assurance in that the state does not invest all that we invest, hoping we prevail in a lawsuit and get some money back from HRK? But what is there in place that prevents the state from investing in closing this site, making it as safe as possible, and then some private entity be able to benefit from that? Do we own this now? Is it part of the receivership documents? I mean, how do we kind of protect our investment?
Secretary Hamilton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. You're right. The site does remain in the ownership of HRK, even though a court-appointed receiver is in place. And keep in mind, too, there are a couple of different things happen here. The site's actively being foreclosed on, and so you've got that in place. But one of the things, to your point, that with that court filing and with the direction that I provided is to do everything to do two things, right? Hold HRK accountable, recover the state's asset, but also make sure, to your point, that we are protective of this final closure. And again, whatever that means, if there's a judgment lien to be had, I want it. If there's anything we can do to protect that resource and that closure in perpetuity, we want to take every possible avenue we can from a legal perspective to do that.
Vice Chair Cheney for a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. And if there's any legislative action needed to empower you to do that, I'm sure you'll come to us immediately, correct?
Mr. Secretary.
With the quickness.
Members, questions? Representative Hardy for another question.
I've just got one follow-up on the well injections. So if people who are concerned about the well injections are right, and we go forward with the well injections, the consequences will be really terrible. If folks who are concerned about the well injections are wrong, the consequences of going forward will be that we don't lose anything. I'm concerned, given the risk reward here, does that affect at all your way of thinking about going forward with those things, where in one case we face a really terrible loss if we're wrong, and in the other case, if the folks who are concerned are wrong, then at least we've taken extra steps to avoid taking any risk with respect to our aquifers.
Secretary Hamilton, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. I go back to the technology. I go back to the science. I go back to the review of this. You know, again, if you understand the science, you understand the requirements, you understand the extensive engineering and geological work that has to go in, and that's, again, that's on us to make sure we educate and continue to provide those answers to the public. But if you understand what goes into construction and quite honestly, if you go all the way back to the development of that rule set and those engineering requirements, they took what you said into consideration, right? What is the risk base? Can we adequately make sure that we have a technology that is safe and is protective of our aquifer? And again, those discussions and the question you have, that is in the foundation of the development of the science and the engineering requirements behind these systems. And so I just want to be clear, it's not a matter of risk or my whatever decision, like, you know, it's a matter of focusing on the rule set, making sure that the science and the engineering, the geology supports the decision, you know, not deciding, because we got to be clear, if there was a risk to the aquifer, if any substantial way from this technology, then we've got a problem with the technology, the rule set, the engineering, and the science, and that is not there. So I just wanted to make sure we understand that thought process.
Members, questions? Final call for questions. Secretary Hamilton, I want to thank you for coming out. You've really done a great job. You've been great to work with and made yourself available. I will say, I do get your weekly and sometimes two or three times a week emails. And so you guys have done a great job keeping folks up to date as it relates to what's going on with the site. So I greatly appreciate that. And we thank you for joining us here today. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Vice Chair Cheney moves we rise.
Thank you.